Thank you to the cops. Appreciate that. It takes a lot of courage. There's a lot of fear in that. It actually ties in perfectly. So pay attention, Elijah. What you just sang fits. You get to see how God's hand works and ties these different aspects of our service together. As I mentioned, this week while we were at camp, one of the things that we usually do with the teens is we set up a couple of Q&A sessions. We let them write questions during the week. Anything that's on their mind, they write them down, and we get together on Friday evening, and then we have another session on Saturday because we usually don't get through all of them. And so we answer these questions the best we can in the time that we have. Normally, we only have one set of guys and girls. So as dorm parents, if you've never been to camp, dorm parents are kind of like the grandparents of the dorm. We get to come in at 9 o'clock at night. We give them a whole bunch of sugar, and then we leave. And we leave the counselors, and we say, have fun with this. So this year, I brought Oreos and EL fudge cookies and zebra cakes. And so normally we have the guys' dorm and the girls' dorm. The four dorm parents do this. This year, because of space, we actually, in my group, we had the B1 and 2 and the G1 and 2. So you're talking about boys and girls from ages 12 all the way up to 15, 16. And so we had probably 50 or so who were all together there at that time. And so we brought them all in, and they ask really good questions. They have a lot of questions that they go through. Anything from Mark of the Beast to the Seven Seals, what age is okay to date. They talk about, you know, how to actually formulate an apology, how to ask somebody for how to say sorry to somebody. What do you do when that person doesn't accept your apology? How do you act then? And so they go through all of these questions, and some of these we turn back to parents. You know, we give them the information of things like dating. You know, we need to have a conversation with your parents and come to a discussion and communicate and give your feelings and get their feedback. But a lot of these are biblically sound, and we can take them back to Scripture and show them the answers to some of these things. As I mentioned, oftentimes we run out of time. This year was one of the things. And we always tell the teens, you know, grab us at any point. If you still have more questions or you want a more thorough answer, let us know. Come and find us, and we'll go through it even more. And I had a couple campers who came up afterwards. And one of them, he asked about why is there so much suffering? Why do people suffer? Why does God allow it? And it's a fantastic question. It's a really good question when we look at what the world's going through, and we find answers from God. When we literally look at it and dive into God's Scripture, He gives us a little bit of that information. And so today's title is, what's your viewpoint? What's your viewpoint? You can go ahead and start turning over to Job chapter 1. We're going to spend most of the day here. The book of Job is a profound and very unique book, and it gives us a massive amount of information when we're talking about hardships, trials, things that we don't quite understand at times. The setting for the book is in the land of Uz. This is where Job lives. Job is the main character. Oh, who wrote the book? The author's anonymous, and it doesn't really set a clear picture of the period of time that this takes place. And it kind of seems like it's intentional. They purposely don't give you this information. It seems like the author is really wanting us to hone in and focus, not being distracted by all the historical elements and getting all of these other extra questions popping up, but rather really focusing on the story of Job, his life, his situation, the friends that he's talking with and communicating with, and the questions that arise from his suffering, the things that he's going through. Now, using context clues, we've been able to sift through some of that. Jewish tradition teaches that Moses is the one that actually wrote it. There's other ideas that the book was written by Job himself. Some believe that Solomon wrote it. Well, we don't know for sure. All of these things kind of look like they could be true to some degree. As far as the timing of when this was written, if we look at some of the history there and look at some of the background, it doesn't give us an exact point, but it looks like this was at the time of the patriarchs, at some point before Israel. And the way we kind of sift through that is we know that Job did sacrifices. And after Israel became a nation, all of the sacrifices were supposed to be done by the Levitical priesthood, but Job was doing this. So it looks like it was before the nation of Israel was together. The book of Job is a very clear literary design. It's a beautiful poetic book, and it opens up in this short narrative, and it closes in a narrative, this prologue and this epilogue that go together. The central part of the book here is dense Hebrew poetry. And it's beautiful. It's a long section of scripture, but it's really beautiful when you go through it and look at it and see how it's written and what all is covered. But it's representing this conversation that Job has with four other friends that he calls his friends. And we're going to see that, yeah, things didn't quite align, but they were friends. They showed up in a time of need. And then these conversations were concluded by a series of poetic discussions or poetic speeches given by God himself, kind of straightening everybody out, aligning out what exactly is supposed to be going on. And so this prologue introduces us to Job. We're told that he's blameless. He's this upright man who honors God. So if you look at chapter 1 and verse 6 through 12, we'll start out reading here a little bit in the beginning. It says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' And so Satan answered the Lord, said, 'From going to and fro from the earth and walking back and forth from it.' And then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?' So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the works of his hand, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face.' It says, 'And the Lord said to Satan, Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person.' And so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord." So Job, he's a super good guy. Not that he's actually perfect, but what it talks about is he is this person of high moral character. He is upright. He honors God. He has a right focus in his life of noticing what God has done for him. And that's his focus. That's who he is. Now, the word Satan here, which is in Hebrew, means the accuser or prosecutor. It kind of brings to mind a court scenario, right? Satan accusing Job of, hey, he's only doing this because you've given him all this stuff. You've bought him. You've purchased him because you've given him so many blessings and all of these things. He goes, this is exhibit one, right? God says, well, look at Job. Job is righteous. And Satan's going, hang on, no. All of this information that you're saying, he's this upright man, it comes with a cost, at a price. And he goes, this is fake. He says, he'll actually curse your name if you take all this away. You bought Job's loyalty. And so what we find is that God says, okay, you can do what you want, just don't touch him. Don't touch his body. We'll see how righteous he actually is. Now, at this point in the story, oftentimes us, along with a big portion of the world, is sitting back, scratching our heads, going, what in the world did God just do? Well, what is he doing? Are you kidding me right now? Why would he allow this man, who he says is upright, who is righteous, blameless, to be the brunt of this attack from Satan, a direct attack from Satan? We don't always understand it, and we don't always understand exactly what this means, that God's giving Satan the power to destroy his possessions, these worldly things that he has, and even his family to some degree. Why would he do this? What is the point of this? Well, part of it, we believe that this is actually telling us something positive. It's just showing us that there's a level that Satan can't cross, a degree that Satan can't go past without permission. God limits what Satan's able to do. Satan can't do anything outside of what God allows. He is that barrier. And God actually permits this. He says, this is what you can do. And so this should actually give us a little bit of comfort, even though we see this horrible scenario that we're about to read through parts of and how this plays up and out and the discomfort that Job goes through. Many people in the world feel that this is very disturbing, that God would even allow this. that Satan would be allowed to do these terrible things to Job and deal with the loss that he does, family, his possessions. But it's supposed to be a comfort. It's supposed to reassure us and remind us that there's a limit to what Satan's able to do. And God always has to allow that. God always has to say, okay, this is the limit that you can do. When we get here, we look at this, we look at the scenario, we look at the discussion between God and Satan, and we go, okay, we assume that he's going to address this question of why does he allow this suffering? Why does he allow these hardships, these bad things? Why does God allow good people to go through difficult things? And we're wanting a direct answer. We want a specific explanation of why is Job going through this? And what ends up happening is this prologue here sets up a different questions. It's actually multiple questions. And he never directly answers why he allows this suffering to take place with Job. Now we can read through this story. We can understand by the end of it in the epilogue and understand exactly the point that God is making and what he's trying to do. And we'll get to that a little bit later. But what this prologue sets up, the questions that this is, the real questions we get to are questions about God's justice and whether or not God operates the universe with a very strict principle of justice. Justice trumping all, right? Everything is based off of this. If something is just, good things have to happen. If it's unjust, bad things have to happen. Is this a strict, hard line that God takes? We end up getting to this question throughout this book, and it really ends up guiding us to the understanding of why Job is dealing with the situation that we find him in here. Even though it's not directly explained, we see what God is doing, and we draw something out of this. If you look here at the end of chapter 1, Job loses his property and his children, but we still see something about his character. He's still showing us who he is. If you look at verse 20, Job chapter 1, verse 20 through 22, it says, "Then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head. And he fell to the ground and worshipped and said, 'Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked shall I return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.' In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong." So what we go through, chapter 1 explains he allowed all of his livestock. He was extremely wealthy. Camel, sheep, I forget what all it names. But everything was killed. It was either killed or taken. Some of it was in a hailstorm. Some of it was raiders that came through. Not only was that, his servants were all killed. All but one from each group. Each group that came back was explaining what happened. So these were people that were close to him, that he had relationships with. So he's grieved deeply here. He's cut to the heart. He lost his children. Some of his children, we know, were at least in that party they were having, and they died. And so he is cut right now. But Job's response is still one of humility to God, saying, "Listen, all right, I know everything comes from you. I know you give us everything, and you can take it away." He acknowledges God's sovereignty over all circumstances, which is absolutely remarkable when you think about what he just endured, watching several of his children die, at least, and all of his property, all of his wealth that he had accumulated. And now we start to see a little bit of why God says he's an upright man. He's an honest man, honorable. And for Job, he didn't have the special knowledge that we do of being able to read the book, God-breathed words of telling us this conversation that God had with Satan and saying, all right, he's being set up. There's a limit to this. He's got no idea any of that's going on. This just happens in his life, this tragedy. And despite the horror of what's happened, he doesn't feel abandoned by God. He doesn't yell at God. It says he did not sin. He did not sin. In chapter 2, we see God allows Satan to take it to another step. One step further. He allows Satan to actually touch his body now. He impact his personal well-being. And that's what he does. He causes harm to Job's body. And the prologue ends with a suffering and a bewildered Job. And towards the end, he starts being rebuked by his wife. And look at verse 9 of chapter 2. Verse 9 says, "Then his wife said to him, 'Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die.'" One thing that we need to consider, I know that oftentimes people have thrown Job's wife out there as this nagging, terrible person. This wife is going, "Give it all up. Throw it away. God has abandoned you. Just deal with it." But what we don't actually think about is she has gone through this traumatic experience too. She went through this loss of children, loss of wealth, and now she's watching her husband have these boils and be in this immense amount of pain. She's watching this man that she loved, after all going through all the other grieving, she's watching the man that has taken care of her family just be miserable. And so it may not be out of hatred of God, but more so of mercy. You know, we get to that point where we see people suffering so much that we go, there's a mercy to God when they finally go to sleep, right? Because the next thing they know, they're going to wake up to a resurrection of a different body. And we know that there's a peace of mind that comes with that. And so it's difficult for people to understand this, but she may have been angry with God and not really understood. But this isn't, she wasn't prodding her husband. She was trying to have mercy. She was having pity for him, going, "I don't want you to go through this anymore. You know, rest," right? Because we know that's what death is. It's a rest. And he no longer, and for her, she may have thought he was terminally ill. With what he was going through, it looked like he was on his way out. And so these few words from her may have been her looking for immediate relief for him. And not necessarily a rejection of God or a rejection of what God has done in their life. But Job was still this great man. He's going through this. He's even more painful, more suffering now. It wasn't just the feelings that were getting hit. He was in physical pain. But he responds to her in verse 10 that we still see this persistent faithfulness. Look at verse 10. It says, It says, "But he said to her, 'You speak as one of the foolish women, of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and shall not accept adversity?' In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." So he's still sticking to it, saying, listen, God gave us a massive amount of good things. He goes, sometimes there's hardships. He goes, this is pretty bottom of the barrel. We're in almost worst case scenario here. He goes, but, you know, God gives us good things and God deals with us poorly at times. Things happen. And he's sticking to his faithfulness, saying, you know, God has this. I understand that this isn't ideal, but we know what God is. We know who he is. So at this point, he's going to be approached by three friends, and it says they came to mourn, right? They're coming to mourn with him, to comfort him, as well as we find out they're going to try to provide him some counsel, give him some wisdom, try to straighten him out, get his situation a little bit better. People reasonably wonder why, you know, if God was such a devoted saint, you know, why would God allow all this harm? Why is God going to allow this suffering to take place? We look around us. You know, I went through if you look at the back of the bulletin, there's a list of people in the church that need prayers right now, that are going through difficult situations. Oftentimes, the world looks at this situation with Job as being this upright man and this conversation that God has, and they believe that this is some kind of contest between God and Satan. It's kind of like a chess match. That Satan's trying to one-up God. And then it's these two power struggles going back and forth. And Job is just at the mercy caught in between. He's this frivolous pawn that gets thrown around, thrown into the dirt. Many people actually reject this as a fictitious because of this. They go, there's no way that a loving God would ever let this happen, would ever watch somebody go through this, especially a faithful servant, somebody who's doing the right things. But the perspective of Job as a pawn here doesn't really match up. It's a little bit off base, especially if you remember what we read. God's the one that actually brought this up. Satan didn't bring this up first. God says, have you considered my servant Job? And that's where the conversation starts. That's where Satan starts throwing around accusations of, oh, no. You've put a hedge around him. He's only loyal because you have given him things. And it's how we go back to see that this is starting this base for us to understand that there's a sovereignty to God that we don't have, that we don't understand. There's a sovereignty that he has even over Satan where there's limitations placed on what Satan's even capable of. You know, we find in the New Testament that Satan is the ruler of this world. He's the prince of the power of the air. He's given some liberties, right? He's the king right now of this world. And we see that. It's evident. But there's still a limit to what God allows at times. And so at this point, Job's suffering goes on. And it doesn't stop right here. But what we do find is Satan drops out of the situation. This is the end for Satan. We don't see him anymore. We have these first couple of conversations, and then we just see Job's suffering going on, carrying on. So in the main part of the book, we find that Job first speaks. He talks. It took an entire week. So his friends show up to help him and comfort him. He's just silent. And his good friends, they were just there to comfort him. You know, the time where we just show up and we give somebody a hug and we hold them and we sit with them and hold their hands. And we don't need to say anything. They don't need to hear anything. They just need to know we're there. That's what these friends do. And that's why I said so-called friends, because they start out with the perfect intentions, right intentions. They're doing the things that we need out of those good friends. And so what we find is after his friends are here, we have this back and forth. Job talks, then one of his friends responds, Job responds to that, and another friend responds to that. And there's three cycles that this goes through. Three different cycles of these conversations between Job and these three friends of trying to talk about, you know, is God truly just? Is this world based on this line of justice? And they're trying to get to the root of Job's sufferings, of why he's going through this turmoil. And so they keep working on this huge assumption that God's justice has to look like a certain way. That if you're good, you get good things. And if you're unjust, there's bad things that come. And so by this hard line definition that they're basing their thoughts on, his friends are going, you've done something wrong. Not only do they say you've done something wrong, they start just making up scenarios of sins. They're saying, hey, you could have sinned this way. You could have done this. Could you imagine being in Job's state? If we were in a critical stage where we're sitting in the hospital, we're full of boils, we lost part of our family, we have no money left, and your friends are sitting around the bed with you in the hospital going, you need to figure out what you did. Like, you could have done this. Did you do this last week? Did you say this? We don't want to hear that, do we? He's going, no. No. He goes, I haven't done anything. He goes, this isn't what happened. And they're going, no, but God's just. If you're doing the right things, you should get good things. You must have done something bad. And he's going, no, I haven't done anything. And so we go through this middle section. We're not going to hit on it because it's just back and forth. Take some time to read it. If you're doing the 3-year Bible study, you should have either just gone through it, or if you're a little bit behind like I am, you just got into this, which was funny because I was listening to it this morning. I'm like, oh, we just got to Job. This is interesting because I had just written the sermon. I was like, oh, I know half of this already. That's good. It's a good reminder. And so we have to consider, how does God view this justice? How do we view our situations? How do we view, what is our viewpoint when we're going through life and we hit some of these struggles? We hit some of these lows. Because oftentimes, I know I've done it, we look at our lives and we think, I don't deserve this. You know, I deserve to make more money, or I deserve to be healthier. Why am I going through this? What's going on? We can look around, look at other people sitting in the seats next to us, or know the ones that are at home today because they're having surgery this week and they don't want to get infected by anything. We know that they're good people. We love them. They serve in this way. If you've never received a card from Marlin, then you've never been sick in your life. I can guarantee you that. She is the queen of sending out cards, decorated handmade cards. And so we look at some of these people going, why? Why? And it's easy to get in that mindset. But if our world was based on this hard line of God's justice is you have one column of people doing good things and just and honorable and upright, you get good things. And then on the other side, you have unjust people who are breaking God's laws, who are just doing things in the wrong way. That's all going to be bad. The problem is we're not perfect, so we know we sometimes fall into that category of not righteous people. But if we look at the world en masse, how would our world be different? It would be a terrible world, wouldn't it? There would be so much bad going on. And when people don't have a good relationship with God, as soon as something bad happens, it can be really quick to turn on God and say, this is terrible. They're not going to say, no, I'm not going to sin. God knows what he's doing, like Job did. It's just going to be this snowball effect. And we would live in a very different world if God punished every sinful act in a negative way. Our world would be drastically different. It would be very depressing. It'd be extremely depressing. And so they have this hardline thinking, and this is what they're going through with Job, trying to work through, what did you do? And they talk about this, and they give these arguments of his integrity. And they say, there's got to be something going on. And he's going, no, I'm faithful. I'm faithful. I've not done any of these things that you're claiming. They go, every scenario you've thrown out. He goes, I don't fall into that category. And this is the discussions that they're having. And he's in this unbearable plight, unbearable sores. And he's been mulling this over for months. This isn't just a couple day thing that he goes through. You don't have to turn there, but Job 7 and verse 3 says, so I have been allotted months of futility, and where some nights have been appointed to me. So there's an extended period of time where he's dealing, even though Satan dropped out of the equation, he's still dealing with this physical infirmities. He's still in the pain. He's in the turmoil for months. And Job's constant argument is that he's innocent. He's innocent. He's telling his friends, this isn't punishment. This isn't divine intervention by God. He goes, I'm not being punished. The friends just stick to their hardline idea of that God's justice equates good with good and bad with bad. There's only two columns. There's no in-betweens. And they're fitting God inside this little box. And they're having trouble getting any of this to make sense between them all. Because Job keeps going back. He goes, I didn't do anything. And we see this come up. And in fact, he starts to get fed up with it. Right? That's why I called them so-called friends. They were doing the right things. They sat with him for an entire week, comforted him, was there with him. And then all of a sudden, as friends do, we oftentimes cross that line and start pushing buttons. And they're going, okay, what's going on? And so he's starting to get fed up with it. And he's going, you're not listening to me. You're not listening. Flip over to chapter 9, verse 21. Job chapter 9, verse 21. Because, Job's protesting these claims, and he's getting fed up, and he actually gives up on them. And he starts to take his calls up directly with God. And he goes, listen, you're not getting it. You're not understanding. He goes, I want to talk to God. I want to sort this out and figure out what's going on. And at this point, Job's been on an emotional roller coaster. He's been on a physical roller coaster. He's got this mindset. He knows that God's just. He knows that that's how he works. But he can't reconcile his suffering with God being just anymore. There's something that changes. We saw in chapters 1 and 2, he had this attitude of, God knows what he's doing, God's going to work this out, everything's okay. Not okay, but he's going, it'll work out, because God's in control. And at this point, we start to see a little bit of an outburst from him, and Job actually accuses God here. Look at Job chapter 9, if you look at verse 21. He says, in verses 21 through 24, he says, I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. It is all one thing, and therefore I say he destroys the blameless and the wicked. If the scourge slays suddenly, he laughs at the plight of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the face of its judges. If it is not he, who else could it be? He's making an accusation here. He's calling God a bully. He's saying these bad things are happening. He's saying, now you're orchestrating these things. He goes, I know you're there, I believe in you, but these injustices now, they're in your control. And he accuses God. But the moment that he utters that, he becomes terrified. Because he goes, what did I just say? And we've all been there. We blurted something out, we go, hang on, let me backtrack that. Hold on, that's not what I meant, that's not what I said. Or we're praying to God and something comes into our head and we're going, wait, nope. And that's where he finds himself, because he wants to hope and believe that God truly is just. He's seen it play out in his life. And so he makes one last statement of innocence, of his innocence. And he still demands that God show up. He wants to personally take his cause up with God. He wants God to explain himself to what's going on, why Job is going through these things. If you remember when we were at the prologue, God actually said Job was righteous and he was blameless, this upright man. Hold your finger here, put your little ribbon here, because we're going to come right back to Job. But if you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 19, it's 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 19. It's interesting here because the Apostle Paul quotes the words of Eliphaz. So Eliphaz is one of these three friends that show up in the picture. He quotes from Job chapter 5. Because Job's friend make a valid point, but the way God runs everything is way above our comprehension. When we think about our perspective and our viewpoint and the things that we see, God sees it on a whole nother level. He's well above our comprehension at times. But when we're going through it, we'd like to ignore that sometimes. We'd like to forget about that standpoint. And look at 1 Corinthians chapter 3, if you look at verses 18 through 23. It says, let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you seems to be wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, he catches the wise in their own craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. And therefore, let no one boast in men, for all things are yours. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas, or the world or life or death, or things present or things to come, all are yours. And you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. He wraps this up really quickly there at the end. He goes, none of this matters in the context of things and things and things and things. He goes, everything's Christ and Christ is God's. Everything boils up to that point where we all belong to God. All things belong to God. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. It serves as a general principle for all of us that there's a level of things that we just don't understand at times. There's things that we just don't get. And we see that playing out with Job. We see Job in the midst of this life, and he's trying to sort it out. And he's trying to understand it, and he's getting upset at times. And he's trying to just understand. And he's losing control a little bit. And it looks unfair. It looks unjust, but when we really boil down and look at what is unjust, what's really unjust is that the Father gave up a son to die for every single one of us. That's where we look and say, you want to talk about unjust? Somebody gave up their life for us. We had a brother who loved us so much that he became the sacrifice for our sins. And so God can sit there and go, you don't know what unjust is. He goes, everything is just. I'm making sure of that. I'm playing this out. I'm playing this out so that I can build a larger family, so that I can bring you into my family. Now, when we're in the midst of these trials, our viewpoint is very skewed because we're going, I don't feel like waking up tomorrow. This hurts. And we get into those dark states, and sometimes our situations are just out of our control. And we go through life and we look at the world, and it's not always fair from our standpoint. There's many times in our lives that sin leads to bad consequences, negative things. There's often times when we live righteously, we do things exactly as God tells us, and it results in good things. We're blessed because of it. And then there's these other things that get thrown in where we do something good and bad things happen, whether it's we keep the Sabbath and we lose a job, or who knows what it is. Where we see people who do bad things, and they're rich beyond belief, and everything's working out. We're going, well, this doesn't make sense. But we live in a just world based off of God is building us to bring all of us into His family. And sometimes that's the challenge that we deal with, of trying to make sure we see that first above everything else. That we remember what was given up. You flip back over to Job chapter 31 and verse 35, because Job acknowledges that this principle is true, right? As an upright man, he understands that God is just, yet he's still viewing himself as innocent, and he's still going through this, trying to sort through and understand exactly what's taking place. And so in chapter 31, he basically places himself under an oath of innocence. He's still sticking to his guns here, and he's inviting God to impose curses on him, and if he can be proven guilty. He goes, do whatever you want if you can prove my guilt. He goes, but I've been doing everything the way you ask. Look at Job 31 and verse 35. It says, oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. That's what the New King James Version says. In verse 35, the here is my mark. The NIV says, I sign now my defense. So he's saying, this is it. This is what I'm claiming to do. In other words, this chapter, Job is resting his case. He's pleading, saying, listen, I haven't broken any of these things. I've done what you've asked of me. And so he's waiting to hear from God. He's told him, he goes, I want to hear from you. He said, explain yourself to me. I want to understand this. And so he's waiting for God to answer. And it's clear from this chapter that Job is confident in his acquittal, right? Job's confident that God's not going to find any fault, that all of these things that the friends were claiming that could be potential sins in his life, he's going, you're not going to find it in my life. In the rest of 35, it says, oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor. Interesting word, right? Because that's what Satan was in the beginning. He was that accuser, that prosecutor. This word prosecutor means quarrel, adversary, controversy. Somebody who's creating these difficulties in our life. This is what he's now placing on God. He says, oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. And so we really see this shift in his viewpoint. We see this stark difference from how he handled this hardships in the beginning, not sinning, sticking to it, saying, God's got this worked out. God knows what he's doing. To now he's going, explain yourself. He's saying, you're causing all of this chaos. I want an explanation. I want an answer. In verses 35 and 36, it says, surely I would carry it on my shoulder, I'd bind it and bind it on me like a crown. I would declare to him the number of my steps, like a prince I would approach him. Job says, I'll carry this list of accusations to God. And he goes, I'll answer every single one of them. He goes, this is who I am. This is what I've been doing. I'll answer. I'll account for it. And he says he's approaching God as this prince, boldly, right? Princes aren't scared of anybody because they're next in line to become king. That's what he's setting himself up as. He's not running away from God. He says, I know what your justice is. He goes, I deserve justice. And he's going, I want an answer. If you look at chapter 34 and verse 5, just flip over just a couple of pages. Because Job concludes that argument there, accusing God, basically. And so it's now at this point where a surprise friend pops up, Elihu, and he argues that God is just, and therefore God always operates based off of justice. He kind of resets the tone here. If you look at chapter 34, starting in verse 5, it says, For Job has said, I am righteous, but God has taken away my justice. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. What man is like Job, who drinks scorn like water, who goes in the company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men? So he's not saying, Elihu's not saying that he's a wicked person here or literally keeping company with these bad people. He's rather saying, listen, your attitude has shifted. Your comments now are aligning with those people who reject God. He's saying this stance that you're now taking, this host of scornful, wicked men on earth, he goes, these people that are around you, that live around you, that disdain God, that don't understand him, that don't understand his justice, he goes, this is how you're acting. You're having that same disdain. You're not seeing the benefits of serving God anymore. So that's what he's trying to help him recognize. In verse 9 it says, For he has said, It profits a man nothing that he should delight in God. Therefore listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness, and from the Almighty to commit iniquity. So Elihu's drawing this more sophisticated conclusion about God and why people suffer. He's trying to refocus. He gets into this next section talking about, you know, this may not be about a person sinning, but he's saying, you know, he leads into this that God may allow this sin to keep us from sinning in the future. Not that somebody has already done it or somebody is actively doing it, but he's saying all of this pain, all of this turmoil that people go through at times, he goes, sometimes that's God building them character. He says that's a character building process. It's God's trying to teach them valuable lessons to get them to where God wants us to be. God's always taking us somewhere. We heard that from the sermonette, didn't we? God is taking us places. And sometimes it's physically in this world. I never thought I'd leave Cincinnati. We had our little Creech Phelps compound. We bunkered down. We were going to ride it out there. Until God opens a door and goes, boom. And you go, you can either fight it, which usually doesn't end up really well, or you can go, okay, I'm along for the ride. Show me what you want me to do. Show me where I'm going. And so Elihu sets this different tone. He puts a different perspective on this. And he's going, hey, Job, you're completely out of place. You're completely wrong to call God unjust. He says, if you're saying God is unjust, then you've got a big problem. Job doesn't even respond. I assume that this was an awakening for him, that he realized where he'd stepped into, and these words from Elihu really kind of sunk in, and he doesn't even respond. Now, Elihu may not have been the best friend. He may not have had the best tact. When you read through what he says, he may not have appropriately considered the condition that Job was in at the time, but it appears that it's what was needed to be said. It kind of reframed this, and he intervened at a point where it started to take a really bad turn, and he refocused everything. I think this is what God had wanted, because what we find out next, if you look at chapter 38 and verse 1, Job had wanted an audience with God, and guess what? He got it. Sometimes we had to be really careful what we ask for. And Job asked and asked, and he got pretty blunt. And it seems like a little bit, one of those situations where we bite off a little bit more than we can chew. Because all of a sudden, God shows up in a whirlwind. If you look at verses 1 through 3, God responds to Job personally. And it says here in the first three verses, it says, "Then the Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind and said, 'Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me.'" That's terrifying. Now, if we don't read that, and if you don't get goosebumps thinking, have I ever put myself in this position where I'm asking God going, I don't understand this, and we get upset, and we get an attitude with God, and we're asking for answers? We have a perfect example of somebody who went through a very tough situation and goes, I want answers. And God goes, all right, sit down, buckle up. I'll give you some answers. He goes, you're going to sit there and you're going to answer and you're going to talk when I say to talk. It's terrifying. And so he first addresses Job's accusation that he's unjust, that he's incompetent to actually run the universe. You know, Job's gone through all this stuff. Some of these claims of God not loving, God being unjust. And so God takes him on this virtual tour of the universe. He takes him through this and he asks some questions about the cosmos. He's going, where were you when this was done? Where were you when this was done? And he starts to really make some, basically saying, when I architected the world, what was your part? What did you have to do with any of this? Did you organize the constellations? Can you change the weather? What are you capable of? Can you make the sun rise? What are you capable of? Because you're sitting there in the seat. He goes, I'm asking questions. I want answers to these questions now. He goes, what are you capable of? God doesn't stop there. He goes to the more physical things that we see. He brings it down a level, right? When we look at the stars at night, that's a whole vast realm of what God's doing that we just go, man, I can't wait till he tells us what all this is about. And then he brings it down and he goes, all right, what about the grazing habits of mountain goats? What about the birth of deer giving birth? What about the feeding habits of lions? What about donkeys, wild donkeys? He goes, what about these things? He goes, tell me, what's the point of all of this? How does this work? These are physical things that you see regularly. And we take a step back and we remember the assumptions that Job and his friends were taking, that the viewpoint that they had about what it looks like to run the universe, to run the world, for everything to function properly according to justice, of how God does that. Underneath that assumption that God has to work on these hard lines of just and unjust, there's a whole another level. There's a deeper assumption that goes on to that his friends had, that they're making this claim that God stuck to these hard lines, and God's response is, look at all of this. He goes, look at what I'm capable of. His friends said, God has to run the world like this. And that's why they gave those scenarios of you've done this, or maybe you've done this. And they're just throwing things out there. And God says, let me take you on a tour. And he deconstructs all the assumptions. He first shows how the universe is so complex, but how he has eyes on all of it. How he's still handling all of it. Every little detail. Every little detail, he says, I'm in control of this. He says, I've got this. Job, with the life experience that he had this tiny little horizon that he could draw from. His own experiences, his viewpoint, his life, the expectations. God's saying, you have to have an infinitely larger viewpoint. You have to have a different perspective because you don't see all that I see. And so what looks like divine injustice from Job's point of view needs to have a different perspective. In the same way that we find ourselves at times sitting and going, I don't really deserve this. I don't know why I'm going through this. There's always something in play. There's always something that God's doing to take us somewhere, to get us to a point. Job's just simply not in a position to make this huge accusation for God, about God. And so after this virtual tour, God asked Job, hey, do you want to micromanage all this? Do you want to take the reins? Do you want to do this? According to these strict principles that you and your friends have, that one column's just, the other column's unjust, and you just plug in good and bad when these things get hit. Good things lead to blessings, bad things lead to precise retribution or harmful things, punishments. Like I said, the world would be a very different place if that was our two lines. It would not be pleasant. I don't think any of us would enjoy going out anywhere, ever. It would be a very different world. And we know that God is working on a specific plan to draw in as many people as possible into His family. He's taken everybody that is willing to be there. As though that means that His view is something different than ours. God isn't black and white, that He doesn't have these two columns that just is just and unjust is unjust. We look at the Sabbath. He gives us some guidelines for the Sabbath. It's to be holy. We're not supposed to do work. He says, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves. He says, enjoy the Sabbath, right? It's supposed to be something fun, something pleasant. He goes, if you put away your own personal pleasures on the Sabbath and find joy in it, this is good. So he gives us this framework, and then we have to sift out this middle part and go, what is my Sabbath? What am I supposed to do in this box? That's His justice. It's not do this from the time you wake up to the time you go to bed. Here's your schedule for the Sabbath. This is what you do. He gives us the framework and says, work within the context. Justice is the same way. He goes, this is how you live a righteous life. This is what leads to good things. It won't always pan out to be pleasant. He goes, but this is the framework. This is the framework. Time and chance happens. And then the other times, He's trying to take us somewhere. He's trying to do something. And so he gets to his last point. He's describing these two fantastical creatures, the behemoth and the leviathan. I'm not going to get into these two. Some people believe these are poetic depictions of a hippo or a rhino and then a crocodile. And so he gives these. There's a couple different theories about that. Like I said, I don't want to touch on that without giving any specifics. But there's these general principles that we get to towards the end of the book here of where he's taking us and what he wants. Job possibly could have understood that the Leviathan in this picture in the story is to be Satan. Knowing that the trouble and the turmoil that comes from Satan, the harm that came to him was through Satan. That may have been a realization for him, knowing that where that affliction came from, though at times he was blaming God. Now, we talked earlier about that game, that chess game that they were playing, that he was just this pawn. But God responds and assures Job that he's not stepping aside. He's still in control. He's not allowing evil to rule. But there's a reason that he's going through these things. And that's where God says you have to have a different viewpoint. God doesn't bend to the forces of evil. His work is to save humanity. At the times in our lives, sometimes our viewpoint is that evil's winning. Evil's triumphant. But God's much higher than what we see on the face. What we see at this level. And we see that we know that He has things that He wants us to accomplish and work through. And He knew Job could never reach a level that He wanted him to get to unless he went through this. None of us can. None of us can without God. And only God has everything under control. That's where our faith comes in. Only God can judge supreme. He has the omnipotent power. He has omniscient justice. He knows everything. And he says, all you have to do, Job, is trust in me. Submit to what I'm doing. Keep working through this. I've got you. And that's what we need to know sometimes, is that God has us. And so we come back to this big question of why God allows suffering at times. How do we view this in our lives? Well, whether it's earthquakes or flooding, wild animals, sometimes it's other human beings that inflict harm. God doesn't always explain it for us. He doesn't always, we don't always get an answer at the end of the day of why we go through some of this stuff. He says we live in an extremely complex and amazing world. That's why he walked Job through those things. He goes, look at this. Look at the magnificence of it. He goes, this isn't a simple process. God tells Job, you don't have sufficient knowledge to understand what I'm doing right now. He goes, but you'll get it. You'll get it. Job demanded this full explanation from God. God asked for trust. He says, trust in my wisdom. Trust in my character. You know who I am. He goes, trust me. Look at Job 42 in verse 1. Because Job responds. And we see this shift back to this man that we saw in the beginning. He realizes and he acknowledges that he stepped over his bounds, his boundary. Look at the verses 1 through 6. It says, then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything, that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. We see this humility that God wanted him to learn. He was a righteous man before. He was a good man. But God says, I'm going to take your morality to a whole nother level. He goes, you can be better than this. That's why he went through this suffering. That's why God allowed that. That's why God initiated this. His friends go their way. God actually kind of rebukes the friends, said, actually, you need to come and bring sacrifices because of these claims that you've made against Job, this righteous man. He goes, and he can pray for your behalf. I'll forgive you. And so he sets this tone. He says, you're right. You're right. He said, you pledge your case. He goes, but I took you to a whole nother level. I'm taking you somewhere else. He says, I knew they drew the wrong, your friends had the wrong hasty conclusion. You ended up getting there too. He goes, but I got to where I wanted you to be. He goes, you're even better. Job learned a valuable lesson. The book actually concludes Job is restored even more than what he had before. He's richer than he was. He even has more kids. His health is restored. Not as a reward, but as mercy. The same way that every single one of us has grace. That Jesus Christ died on our behalf. Not because of how good we are at sticking to the laws, but that we're trying. That we have faith in God that he's going to uphold his end of the deal. That if we do our best, he's going to get us through and he's going to incorporate us. He's going to graft us into his family. That we will become sons and daughters of God. But he's trying to help us to make corrections on the way. Our viewpoint has to be that he knows where we need to grow. You can write down 1 Peter 1, verse 16. He says, be holy as I am holy. That's what he wants from us. He says, be like me. And sometimes to be holy, that means we've got to go through the muck. We have to revamp who we are. This book is honestly hard to read at times because we say, I don't ever want to be here. But we all find ourselves there. This world isn't perfect. But he's saying, trust me. He goes, I truly care about you. He says, I truly care about you. That has to be our viewpoint. Knowing that he does love us. That he does have the best intentions for us. And so what we find at the end of Job, despite his upright character, he still needed to grow spiritually. There is still another plateau that God said, I know you can get here. I know you can get here. What's funny is the world views Job as being a pawn in this. The interesting thing is that it was Satan that was the unwitting pawn. Satan was being used to make Job an even better person, an even better son. God gave him just enough limit, just enough of a leash to say, all right, I'll use you, sure. And that's why God started this conversation. That's why God kicked this off. And that's why Satan's the pawn and not Job. Job got to where he was, where God wanted him to go. God didn't force him there. God didn't make him go there. Job chose humility. Job chose to see the bigger picture and draw closer to God. What are we doing? Are we drawing closer to God in the times that are most difficult, or are we pushing him away? We know Satan's always going to attack God's people. For those who have God's Holy Spirit, who have been baptized, have had laying on of hands, who have received the Holy Spirit, we become a target. Because now is our opportunity to become children of God. And it puts a big target on our back. And so he knows his job is to destroy us. But God's going to continually make us a better person. He's going to continually take us and prepare us for the jobs and the roles to be part of the kingdom of God. It's what he wants for us. So we too, just like Job, are being perfected. And only God knows how far he can push us and where he wants us to go.